All right. Hello, everyone. Great to be with you again. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Tins Jacobs, and it's great to share the word with you tonight. Listen, for tonight and the next couple of weeks, what we're going to do, we're really going to talk through the issue of fear. You know, I've been a pastor now for 10 years. Yes, 10 years. And it just seems to me that every year, the topic of fear rises up to the surface. And fear is a particular relevant topic in South Africa. It's become part of the air that we breathe. It's become part of a matrix of society. And sometimes we get so used to it that we actually don't realize how much we live in fear. And sometimes it becomes so overwhelming that we feel there's no other way almost of living. But it's important that we talk about fear because God has not given us a spirit of fear. And you know, part of my work is that I obviously see calling, let's rather call it calling, work. It's terrible if you come and see me and that's my job, right? It's better, part of my calling. So when you come and see me and we talk about life and everything in between and girlfriends, boyfriends and all that amazing stuff, always I want to have deep conversations. And then it boils down to there's somebody that I like. But hey, I'm not judging you. I was like that as well and now I'm married. So hallelujah. You will find that one. Anyway, let's go on. Let's not go off too far of a topic. But it just seems to me that inevitably part of a conversation is that decisions is often made out of fear. And see, we have a stark choice. We can either live by faith or we can live by fear. How will you live? What decisions are you going to make? You know, one choice that you make in fear, I guess, is okay. Another choice that you make in fear, it starts adding up. And pretty soon you find yourself living a life of fear where all the choices that you make is choices just to feel safe. But then in the end you wonder why you don't feel alive. I tell you why you don't feel alive. It's because you locked yourself in a prison and threw your own key away. See, no one is going to put you on parole. We have been called to live a life of faith. And that is a scary thing. To live a life of faith is scary. Because we think we've got so much to lose. Yes, I guess that's true. But we can either be alive or we can be imprisoned. Which will it be? Now, we're not going to talk through everything tonight. We're not going to get there. But actually, it's actually very simple what I want from tonight. We're going to take the next couple of weeks and really plow through it. And I want to encourage you to work through this in your own personal life. I don't know where you're at. I don't know what are the things that you struggle with or don't struggle with. But I want to encourage you to grasp this and to really work it. Because we are a generation that cannot live in fear anymore. Amen? You know, in South Africa, we cannot afford that anymore. But for tonight, I think it's actually quite simple what I want. Number one is to say that fear is a bigger enemy than any circumstances that we can face. Fear is the biggest enemy. Yes, the circumstances might be bad, but fear is worse. That's the first thing. And the second thing that goes with it is to make a proclamation to say that Jesus has overcome. Jesus has overcome. It's a very simple two things that I'm asking, but it's profound things because it can shape the very fabric of our lives. Now, before we then start, and what I'm going to do in the next couple of weeks is I'm going to look at sermons, three sermons, of people that lived in dire times, all right? That really went through hectic times and both spoke about the issue of fear. Because you know what? I can talk about my own personal experience and you might talk about your own personal experience, but sometimes you get across somebody that you go like, okay, these guys really went through it. So in a sense, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the worst of the worst of the worst situation. By that, I'm not trying to say that's what's going to happen to us. Please, that's not what I'm saying, all right? I'm not going to say these things is happening to us. That's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is we can learn from these people that overcame in the worst of the worst conditions. All good? But before we get there and the person that I'm going to look at for tonight, just very quickly want to give some definitions of fear and what goes with it is anxiety. And I think it's quite important that we talk through it. Now, fear is a strong emotional reaction. Fear is an emotional reaction. It's emotional, right? It's something that you feel and it's a response, it's a reaction to perceive imminent danger. Fear can be real or imagined. Rational or irrational. Normal or abnormal. The point of fear is not necessarily the size of the threat. You know, some people, they go for bungee jumping. Somebody like that here? Oh no, I want to live another day, right? Some people, that's not so much of an issue. For another person, it's like, no, thank you. Fear is not really based, the way that we perceive fear and experience fear is not necessarily based on the size of a threat. It does not make the threat less or more relevant, but the point is how it makes you respond. Because that response is real to you. And it's causing you to respond in a certain way. So fear itself is the issue here. It's a strong emotional reaction. Fear acts as a protective reaction. In that sense, fear is part of human existence. I think if you're absolutely fearless, you don't fear anything, you have no anxiety, you have no feelings of fear, perhaps we should pray for you as well tonight. All right? Perhaps you're missing something here. Because fear is part of a human response. Jesus was afraid, right? When he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, he was sweating blood. I would call that fear. Fear is a normal reaction, but, and I think this we can also say to one another, fear is a natural emotion designed by God. However, fearfulness is not designed by God. Fear triggers a release of adrenaline. It's got a physical reaction. I remember some years ago, I saw a program, it's on television, so it must be true, where a guy that is a firefighter, now I mean firefighter, so I run into burning buildings for a living. All right, so what are we going to do today? Nah, I don't know. I'm going to run into a building, burning building, right? I mean, that is not a guy that you expect is going to have fear. I mean, that's sort of, you know, I'm afraid of my own shadow. No, please don't be a firefighter because, you know, when a fire comes up, there's shadows all over. Anyway, so that's not going to work, okay? And this guy, the worst of worst happened to him. I'm not kidding you. I really did see this on TV. This guy was driving over a railroad track and the car died on the track. And you know what's happening next. There's a train. Yes. And this guy just completely froze. I mean, here's a guy that for a living does dangerous things, and in that moment, fear made him respond in a way that he wouldn't normally respond. And this train just plowed through his car. He managed to survive it, and I guess that was a whole hoo-ha of a story. This guy survived being frozen on the track in his car, and the train just went through it. But to this day, he cannot explain why he just froze. You see, fear is like that. It's not that predictable, is it? There is a threat. It's a threat to your well-being, and it causes a physical reaction. It causes emotional reaction, and it makes us respond in a way that we do not expect. I think very much tied to it is a concept of anxiety, and I think to some extent we use these terms interchangeably. Now, what is anxiety? Anxiety is sort of an umbrella word that covers the varying degrees of worry and fear, ranging from mild to extreme. But the thing about anxiety is it's uneasiness or distress over a threat or something unknown. Anxiety, fear is something that sort of immediately in your face and you're like, ugh, you're responding to it. But anxiety is almost like it might not. And that's almost a bit worse in a certain sense because it's playing tricks of your mind. Is this thing going to happen? Is it not going to happen? I mean, all of us here, we worry. There's something that we easily worry about. Perhaps it's a situation at work, situation at your family, situation in your own relationships, situation in terms of your own health, a situation in terms of how you feel about yourself, perceive yourself, and it worries you. Did I not do this? Did I do that? Is this going to happen? Is that going to happen? And that uncertainty is causing distress. It's causing it's causing worry. And that is called anxiety. And anxiety is uneasiness or distress over a threat or something unknown. Anxiety stems from uncertainty. It's not in our control. Fearing something will happen, but having no control over whether it will happen or not. And let's be honest with ourselves. We like our little bit of control. We like things to be very ordered and neatly. We like to be notified by God in advance of exactly what's going to happen. and how it's going to happen. I mean, all of us, myself included. And anxiety plays on that uncertainty. I'm certain if it's going to happen or not, and it's causing me to worry, and that worry is working at me and working at me. Anxiety can lead to catastrophic thinking, overestimating the likelihood of danger or negative outcome. Have you experienced in your life where you just explode about something? Somebody goes like, hey, how you doing? I'm atomic warm. The person's like, what the heck just happened here? Why are you over-responding? Because something has been eating at you, working at you. That worry has been going at you for a while. Anxiety becomes a disorder when it becomes so intense that it dominates a person's thoughts, feelings, and actions. I would say pretty much in our country, anxiety is a bit of a disorder. Because when people talk about the country, what dominates it? Anxiety dominates it. What's going to happen? What's going to happen to society? What's going to happen to the political order? What's going to happen with the social conflict that we have? What's going to happen economically? Are we going to be okay? Am I going to be able to build a future here? Is my family going to be safe here one day? See, and people are pessimistic. People are negative when it comes to, especially in South Africa. People are exceptionally negative. Because anxiety is so much part and parcel of who we are. Now, what I'm going to do tonight, I'm going to look at Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer is one of the best-known theologians of the previous century. His book, The Cost of Discipleship, I don't know, buy it, borrow it, steal it. But whatever you do, read it. Okay? And I'll tell you what, you will be convicted from it. Because it's one of those type of books. But he's one of the best-known theologians. And he lived in a time no one wants to live, have lived. And that is Nazi Germany. He was a Christian in Nazi Germany. Now, talk about a country where things has gone wrong. I mean, we're not talking about the Rand plunging. We're talking about Hitler becoming the boss. We're talking about genocide of people. We're talking about a state of terror. We're talking about a nation that has twisted any sense of justice and being right into something that is utterly evil. This is the times that this man lived in and ministered in. Now I'm going to show you a video clip on it, and some of the elements of a video clip is not that comfortable, and I'm going to point that out to you as well. I'm pretty sure you'll be able to do that as well. But what I'd like to say to you before you watch a video clip is, when we normally look at Christians, we tend to almost think that they lived in ideal times where everything was okay. Not true. In fact, you will find mostly of the great heroes of faith in the past, they lived in times that was extraordinarily difficult. And it put extraordinary strains on them. And none of them were perfect. None of them were perfect. Okay, so just keep that in mind, but I think it's important that we see this.
We don't know a ton about Dietrich Bonhoeffer's last hours, but what we know is he was a faithful Christian to the end. In the 1930s, he wrote his famous book, The Cost of Discipleship, but he's probably most famous for his decision to get involved in the plot against Adolf Hitler. And it was not an easy decision for him. The Nazis were getting more and more powerful, and so many people were bamboozled by the complexity of the situation. It's very easy for us with hindsight to say, oh, I would have done this, or the church should have done this, but it was very complex, very difficult. Bonhoeffer was a man who simply wanted to do the will of God. He was the leader of an illegal seminary, an underground seminary of the Confessing Church. Those are the good guys who did not go along with the Nazified state church. He was not seeking to die. He would not make his decisions based on fear. He simply wanted to know, what would the Lord call me to do? And things were changing in Germany very dramatically, and Bonhoeffer was constantly asking the Lord to show him, now what do I do? Now what do I do? This was a time where really when the SS gave orders to destroy synagogues, to burn synagogues. This was 1938. He realized that this attack on the Jews was an attack directly on God himself and on the people of God. And innocent lives are being killed left and right, more and more and more and more and more. When do we say, I have to stop him with violence? I mean, you realize that Bonhoeffer was always thinking these things through logically, but Bonhoeffer also knew that the God of the Scripture is the God of the Scripture. And if he calls me to do something, who am I to even question it? There's a joy in obeying this God. If you're worshiping God, you know that he's exhorting you to act. He's exhorting you to take chances. As long as you're doing it unto him, as long as you're trying to obey him, even if you make mistakes, it's okay. And Bonhoeffer saw lots of people in the church who were afraid. They were acting defensively, acting fearfully, and saying, well, I better not do this, better not do that. Bonhoeffer said, well, better to do something unto the Lord than just hide and just wait for this period to pass. And when the time came actually to get involved in the plot to assassinate Adolf Hitler, he did come to the conclusion that this was what God was calling him to do, and he took action. He was very bold, and he was all about action. And just around this time, he was arrested for his involvement in an operation to get 7 Jews out of Germany. That's a far cry from being involved in the plot to kill Hitler. Then once that plot was uncovered, of course, Bonhoeffer's days were numbered. Bonhoeffer always understood that there's a price you pay, that there's a risk. The difference between action and inaction simply has to do with faith. If you have robust faith in Jesus Christ, you're a different person than somebody who is merely religious. From the moment he really got serious about his faith, Bonhoeffer understood that to give my life to Christ is immediately to give it up, to give it away. So whether he takes it from me literally, whether I die, I'm already supposed to be dead to myself. That's the whole point of it. And so it gives you a strange freedom. You're free. In fact, we know that only about 18 hours before his death, he conducted a service. And this is just before the Gestapo knocks on the door, and they drove him a number of hours to Flossenbürg. And at dawn on the morning of April 9th, 1945, he was hanged. Bonhoeffer had this really extraordinary, and I would say supernatural, ability to hear what God was saying, to get the biblical perspective. And he was astoundingly resolute. And then he was a champion, a hero in being resolute, and not just for himself, but in how he dealt with other people, exhorting them to act, not just to say, well, this is interesting, let's have some more committee meetings, but to think it through to the bottom and then to act.
So obviously the uncomfortable part here is that he had a plot against the life of Hitler. And that's not ordinarily what we do in ministry, right? It's not that I sit there in the office and I go, yeah. And that makes Christians uncomfortable when they think about his life, and they tend to sanitize that bit. But I actually think that's a mistake. I actually think it's a mistake to sanitize it. Because here's the thing, if you were in his shoes, what would you do? I mean, let's make it more real for a moment. If things really goes badly in this country, because I can't stand here today and promise you that it won't, but if it does really go badly, what are you going to do? Are you going to take plan B? It's called Europe. Plan C? It's called Canada. What are you going to do? You know, through the years, and yes, an honest bit, and I have to be very honest about this. I've been a Christian for a long time. I've been involved in church for a long time. I've built friendships with other Christians for a long time now. And through years, I've noticed that people that walk with Jesus If they leave this country because of fear, wherever they go, whether it's Canada, whether it's Europe, they build a good life, but they lose their faith. No exception. I'm not saying if you go to Europe, you're going to lose your faith. But what I'm saying is if you go to Europe for the wrong reason, you will lose your faith. You see, in reality, we have been called. Jesus has called us. And we have this one life to live that calling. And that calling has got a context. It's got a place. Very first story that we find in the Bible in Genesis is Adam and Eve. And Adam and Eve didn't live somewhere in the nether region somewhere. They lived in a certain place, located in a certain area. There's a certain geography to it. There's a context to it. You see, sometimes we feel that we can go anywhere and be anywhere and that God will still do the same thing through us, but it's not true. God has called us for a time and God has called us for a place to do a certain thing. And you've been called for this time because you're alive now. I hope. And you've been called to a certain place. And you must make peace with what is that place. And then God has called you for a certain thing. And you must live that thing. Because the reality, what I think really challenges me about this man. I mean, this man, if you read his work, he is highly gifted. Highly intellectual. This man could probably go anywhere, be anything. He actually lived in Britain and then went back to Germany when things started going badly. And what really challenges me about him is that he had a sense that his life is not his own anymore. You see, when you belong to Jesus, you must realize that Jesus gave his life to you. But relationship then means that you must give your life to him. And you know, we can hold on to our lives, but he who holds on to his life will lose it. And he or she who gives away his or her life will gain it. That is the irony. That is a way in which the Bible flips life. And in our view, life is whatever you can gain. The more money you can get, the more esteem you can get, the more power you can get, the more titles you can get, the more networking you can get, the safer you are, but you will lose all of that. You'll lose all of that. Now, in the midst of this, he preached a certain sermon. Now, this is quite a hectic sermon, right? That I'm giving right here. But we have to talk about the realities that we're facing. We have to talk about the reality of fear. We can only overcome fear if we look fear in the face. We'll not overcome fear if we hide away from it. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at one of his sermons that he preached before the Nazis actually came to power, I think in 1933. At that stage, there was a Hindenburg government that existed, and it was sort of on its last knees. It was being destroyed because society was really struggling in Germany. And there were sort of two threats. There was a far-right sort of movement that was the Nazis, and there was a far-left movement that was the communists. Talk about being between a rock and a hard place, right? And there was fighting on the streets, and people were really afraid. And what do they do in the midst of this? And in the midst of this, he actually preached this sermon. And as a text, he chose Matthew 8. What I'm going to do, I'm going to look at the text and then look at some of his quotes and comment on some of these things. Matthew 8, verse 23 to 27, talks about Jesus in the boat. And it says the following, "Then Jesus got into the boat and started across the lake with his disciples. Suddenly, a fierce storm struck the lake with waves breaking into the boat. But Jesus was sleeping." Isn't it weird how Jesus sometimes sleeps when you need him to be awake? In prayer life, have you experienced that? "The disciples went and woke him up, shouting, 'Lord, save us.'" Now, the Bible is very understated. That's one of the things about the Bible. It's very understated. Because I think they did more than shouting. "Lord, save us. We're going to drown." Jesus responded, "Why are you afraid? You have so little faith." Then he got up, rebuked the wind and waves, and suddenly there was a great calm. The disciples were amazed. "Who's this man?" they asked. "Even the wind and the waves obey him." Now, the first thing that we should see from this and what I take from this is that storms in life, it happens. That is part of life. Storms happen. And I really don't have control over storms. And therefore, fear is a very natural response. Anxiety is a very natural response. I don't think we should blame ourselves that we sometimes feel fear. I don't think we should blame ourselves that we sometimes feel anxious, because reality is storms does come up. And the thing about a storm is that it's this overwhelming force. I'm not talking in a metaphorical sense. It's this overwhelming force that can really destroy us. And what do we do in the face of a storm? We are afraid, because we suddenly realize how small we are. And how little control we have. And how much ever we like to think we are very smart. I mean, I like to think I'm smart. Trust me, just ask my wife. She will tell you. She will tell you. I always think I am so clever and so amazing. And my plans is just so from God. Obviously, it must be, because I said it, you know. We like to think we like that. Maybe you're a bit better than me. But we like to think we're smart. We like to think we're in control. We like to think we've got enough insurance policies. We've worked ourselves in a good enough position. But the reality is, we all know that in the things of life, storms, it does happen. And we can always think it happens to somebody else. But we can actually know it may happen to me as well. In the midst of a storm that is so overwhelming, whatever it may be, the storm of life, it is very natural that we're going to feel, oh my goodness gracious, I am afraid, because there's a very real threat here to my well-being, to my existence. And therefore, we feel so small. In the midst of this, we ask, where's Jesus? What is happening there? And the point of the story, very important point of the story, is that Jesus, though it might sometimes seem that he's sleeping, Jesus is the Lord of the storm. You see, fear does not mean that the circumstances that you're facing is not that important. The storm is very much real. This was not an imagined storm that they had. This was something, I mean, these guys were fishermen. They lived on boats, if I can put it that way. These guys can handle a wave. When a fisherman starts getting afraid, then you know. Then for us mere mortals, we already, I don't know what's happening to us. It was not imagined, it was real. And therefore, the storms in life sometimes can be very real to us. And therefore, fear and anxiety can be very much part of that experience. But Jesus is in the boat. More importantly, Jesus is the Lord of a storm. Now, remember I said there's two things that I want from this evening. The first thing that I want is to say, however big the storm may be, however tough the storm may be, that's not your biggest enemy. Your biggest enemy is fear. I'm not saying the storm is not there. I'm not saying that what you're experiencing or what you may experience is not real. It might be very real, very strong. But what I'm saying is there's even a bigger enemy than that. And it's called fear. Now, what does fear do to us? All right. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in the sermon, writes, and he says the following. He wrote down the sermon. That's why I'm reading it. He says, fear is somehow or other the arch enemy itself. It crouches in people's hearts. It hollows out their insides until their resistance and strength are spent and they suddenly break down. Fear secretly gnaws and eats away at all the ties that bind a person to God and to others. And when in a time of need that person reaches for those ties and clings to them, they break. And the individual sinks back into himself or herself, helpless and despairing, while hell rejoices. Why do I say that fear is a bigger enemy than the storm? Number one, as Dietrich Bonhoeffer said here, fear is a bigger enemy than the storm because the storm is always outside. But fear goes and lives in the deepest part of who we are. It crouches in our hearts. You know, other people can't see it, other people can't measure it, but it's living there. And in that deepest part of who you are, that is what defines you as a person. That is what's shaping your actions. That is what's shaping how you perceive things and how you decide upon things and what sort of future do you hold for yourself. And the deepest part, you know, as the Bible says, guard your heart, for it's a wellspring of life. Whatever's in your heart eventually will come out. And that's why fear is a bigger enemy than the storm when you're facing. Because fear starts living in your heart where the storm is always outside. The second reason why fear is a bigger enemy is because fear eats at us. Fear gnaws away at the strength that we have inside of us until we have that strength no more. And that's why fear can make a very strong person a very cowering person given enough time. Fear can take all the resolve that you've built up and all the things that you know, and it can gnaw away at it until it's quite weak. And how does it do it, very importantly here, is that fear tends to destroy relationships. Have you noticed perhaps in your own life, if you're really anxious about something, you fear something, have you noticed that you actually struggle to pray in that moment? You see, what fear does is fear destroys trust until you struggle to trust somebody else. I've noticed through the years that people that tend to go through the middle age sometimes do weird things. You know what I'm talking about. Somebody's married and the next moment they're not married anymore. Somebody has built a good life and in the moment they make very strange choices that they never should have made. Why? Because in that moment, that person is actually alone. Because fear of what they may lose has eaten away whatever relationships they have. A person that is in fear is a person that struggles to trust other people. Therefore, what happens when you need it most, you actually don't have that strength there. You actually don't have those relationships there. Let's go on. What is the fruit of fear? And I sort of alluded to that. Now, Dietrich Bonhoeffer writes about that. He says, now fear leers that person in the face. He's talking about the imagery now of being in the boat. Picturing ourselves, the disciples that's in the boat, and there's a storm around them. And what happens to them while they're in the boat? Now, fear leers that person in the face, saying, here we are all by ourselves, you and I. Now I'm showing you my true face. And anyone who has seen naked fear revealed has been its victim in terrifying loneliness. Fear of an important decision. Fear of a heavy stroke of fate. Losing one's job. An illness, fear of a vice that one can no longer resist, to which one is enslaved, fear of disgrace, fear of another person, fear of dying. That person knows that fear is only one of the faces of evil itself, one form by which the world at enmity with God grasp for someone. Is it not interesting that the way in which he describes fear here almost becomes like a person? Fear takes for qualities of a person that speaks to you. Now think about that. The Bible actually sort of goes in the same direction. It says 2 Timothy 1 verse 7, we've not been given a spirit. Spirit is a person. It's not a force. We've not been given a spirit of fear. We've been given the Holy Spirit, the spirit of power, of love, of a sound mind. It means that fear can speak to us. Fear can reason with us. Fear is that voice that comes and says, this is what's going to happen. This is a problem. This is the issues. And what happens is that when fear starts really speaking to us, it's like we hear no other voice. It's like you only see fear. You know, when you're really anxious about something, that thing starts filling the horizon. And it's all you think about. It's all you talk about. Now, here's the thing. Tonight, either you are a person in fear, or you're a person that will be tested with fear. All of us will have to face fear some of the stage. Fear, when it's gone to full fruition, becomes that person that speaks to you, and that's the only voice that you hear. And it makes you alone. And you hear nothing else. And that is why fear is the biggest enemy. Now, it just seems to me that one of the things that happens to us is that sometimes we just give over to fear. We call it being a worrywart. We call it being careful. We call it being a well-organized person. We call it being a planner. But what can easily happen to us is that we find it so hard to deal with fear that we rather just give over to fear. Now, some of you may experience that. Some of you will be tested in that. I tell you what, in my life, I never thought that I was a fearful person. Never. I mean, my very name, Tiens, it's a weird name, it's Afrikaans name. You know what it means? It means to be pugnacious. It means to be the guy that always wants to fight. Klein mannetjie syndrome, that's what they call it. Short guy syndrome, right? I'm not afraid. I'm going to get you, all right? You won't get me, I will get you. But eventually, I had to face my own fears. And some of the worst fears that I had to face was when my wife was pregnant and she gave birth, and there's lots of stuff that went wrong there. And I tell you what, in that moment, you are alone. There's no one there. Nobody from the church ran in there. Well, you probably wouldn't be able to. My mom and my dad, they were not there. And in that moment, it's either the voice of Jesus or it's the voice of fear. It is either submitting to fear or submitting to Jesus. Now, I don't know what are the things that might elicit fear for you. Maybe you face some real issues in your life. Maybe you face some real imminent dangers to your life. Maybe you face sickness. I would say this, though. I think for your generation, not that I want to sound like an old guy, but I think for this generation, there's such a fear that somehow I will not be good enough. Somehow I will not be accepted. Somehow I will not get married. And if I get married, it will not be a happy marriage. Somehow, if I stay at this work, I will wither away and die. Somehow, if I do not have the angel Gabriel speaking to me in tongues that I interpret about my mission in life, my life will be a waste of time. It seems to me for you guys that there is such a tremendous pressure to be special, but you're so afraid you never live up to that. Now, it might not be a guy with a panga waiting for you around the dark corner, but I tell you what, that thing can eat away at you. And I see people day after day that are so concerned that they're wasting their life's potential that they're actually not living by faith. And you know, I cannot say that Dietrich Bonhoeffer did the right thing or the wrong thing in plotting the death of Hitler. But what I can say is that he lived in faith. And somehow it seems to me that we're so busy trying to write our own autobiography of success that we want to know whether something will be utterly successful in worldly terms, but we never get around to living it. We're so afraid of making mistakes. We're so afraid we're going to marry the wrong one. By the way, it's not about that. It's about being the right one. Preach it. You're not married yet. Oops. You'll find out. And let's flip that around. We're so afraid we're not going to get married and we're not going to seem normal to everyone else, that we never live a life of faith. And I saw a person this morning, and he said to me, a guy was in tears, he said to me, I'm so tired of pretending. I'm so tired I'm so tired of wanting to look good enough to everyone. And I said to him, what is Jesus saying to you? What is your life of faith? I don't know what is your fears. I don't know what is the things that you're anxious about. But I tell you what, it just seems to me like people are desperately unhappy in general. Desperately unhappy because somehow there must be something better out there. Here's the thing. Jesus can call me and you to be like Dietrich Bonhoeffer and live in Nazi Germany. That is a worse place. There might be even worse places than that, to be honest. But I will not let the storm determine my happiness. That is a power of fear. That is fear looking me in the face and saying, I control you. Who controls you? Who controls you? See, we might say we are in control, but in reality, we all serve someone. Who do you serve? You know how you find out who you serve? It's by who you're listening to the most. It's very easy. Which voice is talking to you? It's a hard saying, and I've got to measure myself by that. I'm not just preaching at you, I'm preaching at myself as well. I'll listen to my own recording, then make sure that I do it. All right? I don't know the things that you're afraid of, but you must say to yourself, whatever the circumstances, fear is even worse. Your dread of being stuck in a mediocre work, that dread is actually worse than being actually stuck in a mediocre work. Because at least you have work. A lot of people in this world don't have that privilege. See, fear can become all-consuming. And fear cannot always be based on reality, but it does not make the storm any less. But fear is a big enemy, and fear makes us alone. What we will do in the midst of it. You see, why I'm having a straight talk to you is because when you face fear, will you have saving faith or will you submit to the voice of fear? See, there comes key moments in your life where you have to make key decisions. What will you listen to then? You see, there's two things that is really important to me tonight. I obviously said what is the outcome, but I think the proclamation of Jesus, that Jesus has won the victory. That is the first step, and obviously we're going to sort of talk more about that in the coming weeks. But the proclamation of a victory of Jesus, I think, is very important for tonight, and then obviously declaring that fear is a bigger enemy than any circumstances that we face. But why I'm talking about the topic of fear, I think, is two things. I think for this generation in South Africa, we've got to do things different from previous generations, right? And we can throw rocks at them, we can say this and that about them, but the honest truth is most of the decisions were decisions made in fear. And if the root is not good, the fruit is not good either. And when we start living in fear, we start doing things to other people, and we start rationalizing things. Cannot live in fear. You see, we're already seeing that cycle growing in South Africa where violence is growing in this country. Why? Because of fear. Fear that I will not have enough to live. Fear that somebody's going to take away what I have to live. But fear is driving people. Then on a personal note, a life lived in fear is a life not lived at all. It's an imprisoned life. Now, the solution for this is having saving faith. And I'm putting that word saving faith in there on purpose. Matthew 8, verse 23, verse 27, the disciples calling out, Lord, save us. Save us. We're going to drown. And Jesus responded. Now, there's another story of a well-known Christian figure in history. It's a man called Charles Wesley. He's the founder of a Methodist movement. And I mean, this was in the 1700s, and the influence of this man still lasts up to today. I mean, you can still pretty much go into all kinds of neighborhoods and find a Methodist church. So this guy did a lot. And when we look at somebody like Wesley, we'd go like, goodness gracious, this man must have moved with extraordinary faith. This man must have had like huge intimacy with God. All right, that's my expectation. When I hear the name and I see what he's done, I go like, dude, this guy He's got it together. Now, Wesley writes a story in his diary. He recounts something that happened to him in his diary, and that's in the early stage of his ministry. He actually really struggled. He went to America and had a torrid time. People actually kicked him out and said, "You don't know what you're talking about." All right, the worst thing you could say to a minister after preaching is, well, let me recount. So one thing that you could say that's really terrible is, "I understood nothing that you said." That hurts particularly bad. Yeah, that makes you cry on the pillow at night. But the other one that's really bad is when people say, "That was not biblical at all." That's never been said to me, I think. and then the other thing was, you know, with the Azusa Street revival, there was a Tani that was sitting right in front. And whoever would preach, she'd feel the Holy Spirit moving when this guy would preach. And if she didn't feel it, she'll say to the guy, "Listen, you know you don't have it. Get off stage." I mean, talk about performance anxiety right there. I'm so glad I'm not in that church. You guys are very nice. You're very nice. Let me just say that. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yeah, so he got kicked out in America. People didn't want to listen. He had a torrid time in America. But something happened to him on his way there that changed his life and really made him think, and it changed everything about him. And what happened was this. He was on a boat, obviously, in the 1700s. No SAA then. On a boat from England. And with him, there were some German missionaries, Moravian missionaries. And he was a man that was very attentive to details, if you look at his writings. And he saw the way in which these people responded, these Moravian missionaries. And he saw how other people tried to provoke them because they heard that he's a missionary, all right? Or they heard they were missionaries. And sometimes there was insults, and he observed that they were very gracious in their response. Now, these people had their families with them, all right? We're not talking about missions these days where you fly to Europe and try and survive the Euro and then fly back to your family. We're talking about your family comes with you on the ship, all right? Because you're going for long term when you do go. And people were insulting them, they were insulting their families, and they were very gracious in their response. He noted that. He noted how people would even sometimes push them on purpose, sort of physically just try and intimidate them and try and get sort of a reaction from them. And he would notice how gracious they were to a person when this sort of thing happened to them. But then one Sunday, when they were very close to the coast of America, these Moravian missionaries were having a church service. And as they were having a church service, a massive storm arose. And the storm was so bad that the mast of a ship broke. And the ship was shaking. And then, he couldn't help himself, he was still noticing something. What he noticed was that the Moravian missionaries, with their families and children, they continued to the worship service as if nothing was happening. Even as the waves was breaking over the ship, they continued as if nothing was happening. And yet all the other people that were mocking them were screaming their lungs out. And then he looked at himself and he realized he himself was screaming his lungs out. He was on his way to preach to America and he was screaming his lungs out. All right? And then he went to one of the families afterwards and he said, "Were you afraid?" Because the storm died down. Unfortunately, nothing further happened to them. They were okay. But he went to one of the families and said, "Were you afraid?" And he said, "By the grace of God, no." And he looked at the children, he looked at the wives, and he realized these people are not afraid. And then he realized, and this is the point, then he realized he's always had faith, but he's never had faith like that. And he called it saving faith. Faith that can look fear in the eye and overcome it. And that is what we're contending for. We're not contending just for faith. We're contending for saving faith. Because in a sense, faith is not enough, if that makes sense. There's a quality of faith, an intensity of faith, a depth of faith of knowing Jesus. Now, Dietrich Bonhoeffer describes it as follows. Now, the cry goes out from the whole crew. He's still back. I'm still back with the image of the disciples in the boat on the lake, and it's going rough there. Now, the cry goes up from the whole crew. Fear is in the boat. All arms are frozen and drop their oars. All hope is lost. Fear is in the boat. Then it is as if the heaven opened, as the heavenly host himself raised a shout of victory in the midst of hopelessness. Christ is in the boat. Here's the thing. When the storm hits your life, whatever the storm may be, if fear is in the boat, all is lost. But if Jesus is in the boat, all is won. And that is called saving faith. To look at Jesus, because in that moment, Jesus is enough. Matthew 8, verse 23, Jesus responded, "Why are you so afraid? You have so little faith." And it boggles my mind. These disciples, these were the guys that didn't have the Gospels like we have almost secondhand. They walked with Jesus. And I mean, Jesus did not play around, that we know. He was healing people. He was driving demons out. He was doing supernatural stuff. He was doing stuff that astounded and amazed people. And yet, these are the guys walking with him. When the storm hit them, they lost it. They lost it. And they said, "Why are you sleeping?" They woke Jesus up, "Save us." And Jesus said to them, "Why do you have so little faith?" You know, you can walk with Jesus and never have saving faith. But that is what we're contending for, to have saving faith. Because saving faith overcomes the fear of death. It overcomes the fear of whatever we face so that we can live a life of faith. Because that is our stark choice. We can either cower and live a life of fear and hide away, or we can live a life of faith and see Jesus do great and amazing things. And that is what we're contending for in this time. Now that is what I'm challenging you with. Do you have that sort of faith, yes or no? And it's okay to say no. It's okay to say, "I had it once, but I don't have it now." So long we decide together tonight to contend for that sort of faith. And that sort of faith only comes from looking at Jesus. That sort of faith only comes from calling on Jesus. Psalm 3 verse 5 says, "I lie down and I sleep." It reminds me of a story of Jesus here. Jesus lied down and he slept. How could he sleep through a storm? I mean, I struggle to sleep through dirt.